Welcome to Imagining the Past, the Summer Autumn Season 2025.
HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to Elders past, present and emerging.
In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from some of the sessions from the HNSA conference held in Sydney on the 21st and 22nd of October 2023. In this session, writer and critic Stephen Romay is in conversation with Jock Sarong and Fiona McFarlane. Jock discusses part 3 of his Fanon trilogy, The Settlement, which was shortlisted for the 2023 ARA Historical Novel Prize. Part 2 of the trilogy won the ARA Prize in 2021. Fiona discusses her second novel, The Sun Walks Down, which was shortlisted for the 2023 Walter Scott Historical Fiction Prize.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this session of the conference. I know it's early on a Sunday morning, but let's hope it all goes well for everyone here and the roof doesn't leak, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm here with Jock and with Fiona. Are you there, Fiona?
I am here, yes. They're just having some trouble with the camera. I hope to appear at any moment.
All right. A bit like Denny, your boy in the bush. We hope he appears too. Good to see you. So we're here to talk, partly at least, about their novels. Jock's The Settlement is the third and final instalment in his historical novel trilogy set off Bass Strait, essentially. And Fiona McFarlane's The Sun Walks Down is...
There she is.
Is
hi.
Set in colonial South Australia in 1883. It unfolds really over the course of 1 week, and it centres on a six-year-old boy named Denny who goes missing in a dust storm. So I'm going to start simply by asking you each about historical fiction. Jock, we'll start with Jock. This is the third book in your historical fiction series, but you've written other books that aren't what we would broadly classify as historical fiction. Yeah. The Rules of Backyard Cricket is one of my favourites, for example. What is it that draws you to writing historical fiction?
Well, for me, it was entirely accidental in the sense that I try to follow my nose into a story, and sometimes those stories are historical and sometimes they're not. It's really as random as that. When I started Preservation, I had this idea about, from being in the Furneaux Islands a lot, from being on Flinders Island a lot, and talking to the locals, I had this idea about a 50-year period in those islands during which a lot of really important Australian history had been transacted. So from the wreck of the Sydney Cove in 1797, through to the closure of the Wibelina settlement in 1847, all of these movements of people and the place, which is a tiny remote place, tells you so much about the way that Australia was colonised and the way that the repercussions continue to ripple out from those points. So I saw the 50 years and I wanted to tell a story about the 50 years. I didn't even intend initially to write a trilogy. I started writing a book and then realised how much material there was, and it started to extrude, if you like. So there is an accidental element to it, but there is also so much to derive morally from writing history, I think, that you immediately you're struck by the idea that these human behaviours keep recurring and that we keep failing to learn.
That's a very good point, that they keep recurring. I think we were talking before about how historical novels work at their best when they're also timely. And what happens in Jock's novel, very relevant today, but we'll get onto that later. Fiona, I think if I'm right about this, The Sun Walks Down is your first foray into historical fiction. Is that right?
Novel-wise, it is, yes. I've written a few historical short stories before, but they've all been 20th century. So this is the oldest I've ever written. 1883 is by far the oldest, yeah.
Yes, and so what drew you to this idea to set a novel in colonial South Australia in 1883?
Well, I visited South Australia after I was at the Adelaide Writers' Week for my first novel, and I went on a trip to the Flinders Ranges for the first time and fell in love with this landscape, and was also just really, really interested in the colonial ruins in that place that sort of told a different story of settlement, a failed settlement, I suppose, a failed white settlement that wasn't one that I had come across necessarily before, or isn't the sort of thing that you hear when you grow up in Sydney, which is all about sort of, well, at least when I was growing up, we had Old Sydney Town, we went and celebrated settlement in ways that seem kind of just unimaginable now. So what I wanted to do was in some way do justice to this extraordinary landscape that was testament to Indigenous resistance, to foolish colonial decisions, and just an incredibly beautiful place at the same time. It is the only place in the world that you can stand and look in one direction and see 350 million years of geological history laid out before you. So when you think of the Flinders Ranges at that scale, 1883 doesn't seem so historical anymore.
Thanks. One of the challenges, I imagine, writing a work of historical fiction is the clear tension between history and fiction. So, for example, Jock, your book, probably the main character is George Augustus Robinson, a real person who essentially gathered Aboriginal people in Tasmania and moved them to this island off Tasmania. It was the colony outside of a colony, as it was is described in the book, a troublesome addendum. He was real. How do you balance his place in history as it's recorded with being a writer of fiction?
Yeah, not easily, I think, is the short answer. When I went into this project, I had read a number of books about Robinson and books that included Robinson. And what I was really struck by was that the authors of these various books had done the research and they had all landed at different conclusions about who he was and what he represented. And I thought, how can this be so malleable? And so I read Robinson's diaries, which are gigantic. He was neurotically obsessed with recording everything he did. And I got to the end and I think I understood the answer, which is that Robinson is ducking and weaving the whole time and he's trying to define himself for us, for what he saw as posterity. And I think you can read him a number of ways, and the criticism is open that I've been too hard on him. But I think he started out with a sort of messianic complex. He wanted to be the saviour of the Palawa and Pakana peoples. And when he realised that the situation had got out of hand on Flinders Island, that literally hundreds of people were dying of respiratory disease under his watch, and he ever so subtly, the rhetoric starts to shift from, I will be the saviour of these people, to I will be the witness to their extinction, and that's also important. So he starts to think about posterity. He starts to think about sending remains to London. He starts to think about publishing his memoirs. He hires Thomas Bock, the convict artist, to paint portraits of the people in his care because he figures they'll be the illustrations for his memoirs. Starts writing letters about the speaking tour in Europe. And when you're reading the diaries are quite anodyne in their language, but you start to have this awful sinking feeling. He's now given up and he's carefully shifting the blame away to Hobart and to Sydney, and he's positioning himself as the expert witness. So the fictional element is trying to understand the emotional landscape that led to those diary entries. And I think writing historical fiction, we're all open to write a spectrum all the way from literal reportage of the archive all the way through to imagined material. as long as we are honest in our compact with the reader, as long as we're making it clear to the reader where we're taking those leaps and where we aren't, and perhaps even, you know, trying to suggest to the reader if this material interests you, or if you're interested in the little the connective tissue between what's archival and what isn't, then here's all these other things you can read. Go and make your own assessments about it.
You do say that in your introduction. You say essentially, reader beware.
Yeah.
There's stuff here I've made up, to summarise.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And you have Robinson at one point, I think it's a very telling point in the novel, thinking he might not be the Messiah, he might be Judas. Mm. But I think the important thing is we still know who Judas is. He's still etched in history. Is that kind of your feeling in Robinson, that either way he wanted to be his name carved in marble?
Yes. Yeah. Robinson had a very strong sense of his own fame, more so as he got older, and he invested money. He became very wealthy. He treated his family appallingly after he left Tasmania. He moved to Europe in the end, remarried, and died. It's hard to tell because he didn't diarize that part of his life, but the impression you get is he died a wealthy, lonely old man, lived to a great age, unlike the people in his care. The Judas moment, there's no telling whether he ever fully assimilated that. I think it's there on the material because he clearly made the promise to people like Manuel Agena, I will take you somewhere safe where you're out of the path of the bullets, and I will keep you there. And when it's safe for you to return to your country, I'll take you back to your country. And what's more, he goes even further and says, I will live among you to ensure your protection as a kind of human shield. Now, he never got anywhere near fulfilling that promise, but a great many people went with him on the strength of that promise. So I think the Judas moment is open on the evidence.
Sure. Manuel Agena is one of the Indigenous chiefs, and we'll come back to the whole Indigenous relationship in a moment. But Fiona, if I'm right in thinking, the characters in your novel are fictional.
Yes.
But the place, you've invented some town names, et cetera, but the place, the Flinders Ranges, is real. The time is real. The relationships between the characters, between the white settlers and the Indigenous population and the many kind of immigrant people who came to settle in South Australia is real. So how did you go about turning that reality into a novel?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that I would agree that the relationships are real and that that's necessarily what my novel was setting out to do. I think that one of the projects I set myself writing this book was to take on the ways in which we sometimes approach historical fiction as if it has to be real in some kind of authoritative way, rather than an investigation or an interrogation of how we represent history. And I was really interested in the fact that every time we choose to represent the past, we're making ethical decisions as well as artistic ones. And so I wanted to write a book that was full of relationships that do feel real. And I love that that is the case. And my characters are very deliberately sort of rounded into textured people with sort of density and extension in their personalities. But I also wanted the book to be really interested in, and maybe this is connecting to what Jock was saying about the contract to the reader, to be extending a contract to the reader within the form of the book itself, that's saying, look, there are lots of different voices who could tell this story. There are lots of different ways in which we could approach this place and these people and this particular tale, especially because I'm dealing with this huge mythic cultural narrative of the white child lost in the wilderness, which in the late 19th century was such a sentimentalized and also racialized narrative that was being told. So I wanted the whole book to feel, I wanted everyone to feel as if they were deeply invested in each of these characters, but at the same time to be continually reminded that I am no authority on any of this, that none of these characters could stand up and tell you exactly what it was like to live in the Flinders Ranges in 1883, that it's about the many different voices and perspectives that could be brought to a story like this and a place like this.
That's interesting what you say about character. I think we can move on to that now, because I think your novel is one of the more brilliant explorations of character I've read in recent times. All of the people in it, you feel as though they're alive and you're with them. And I'll give you the audience a couple of examples. Sometimes you do it in one sentence, such as when Mrs. Axum says something and then she says something like, I can't recall it now, but she laughs as though she was surprised that she had spoken, something like that. And your description of the Anglican vicar, Mr. Daniels, is also brilliant. I'll try to find him. But without me quoting from the novels themselves, what is it that takes you into the lives of these characters and brings all of them, not just the main ones? Everyone has a life in your novel. Sissy has a life. Her comments when she falls in love with the constable, that she can love him, but why listen to him, made me laugh out loud. That sort of depth of psychology is fascinating. So can you talk a little bit about inhabiting your characters, please?
Oh, thank you. That is all really wonderful to hear. And I feel almost as if they are real people who you have complimented now. So, I think this is for me what a lot of fiction is about thinking about what it looks like to be a human being and respond to the physical and psychological world that you're moving through, and the emotional world as well. So I'm fascinated by people, and that's not such an extraordinary thing for a fiction writer to say, but I knew that I wanted these characters to feel as if they could be, right next door, not in 1883, but sort of right next door, or you had a real sense that each of them has and desires and longings and shortcomings and biases and opinions and bad habits and good habits and all of those things all at once. And it feels connected, I think, to the way in which I wanted the book to be kind of very, very overpopulated and quite noisy and quite messy, full of lots of people, all of whose complicated lives could never possibly all achieve their goals and live happily ever after, because that's not the way settlement works. It's not the way invasion works. It's not the way communities so often work. And so I wanted there to be this teeming kind of sense of all of these people who could each step up to be the protagonist of this novel if I let them, but instead had to shuffle off and let someone else step up, and then let someone else, and then someone else.
I think you achieved that very well, and it goes to the diversity of the population of your setting. It isn't just white settlers, Indigenous people. For a start, the white settlers come from European countries. There's the Germans, and there's the visiting Swedish artist, and his wife's English, and there's the Afghan Camelairs. There's the Chinese. You really present a kind of wide variety of people from different ethnic backgrounds that makes a reader understand that it wasn't just white, black at that time. And I found the moment that made me laugh with the vicar. This is the vicar, Mr. Daniels. He's in a room full of women. He's the only man in the room, and a child soils its nappy. And they look at the vicar and expect him to change the nappy. Very well, he says, and steps through the door, nearest doorway. He did, after all, ask the Lord to test him. That made me laugh. What you say about the ethical challenges, we can move on to that, Jock. And perhaps this is sort of a big question, but I'm just going to ask it. What is history, okay, both in its overall sense, but also importantly in how it's recorded? So each of you in your novels have people who record the history that we read. You have Robinson and his voluminous diaries, although, as we know, there are some things he does not allow to be written, things that do happen. And he says, do not write this. Okay. And you, Fiona, have the marvelous Sergeant Foster, who I think is from Port Augusta. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, Port Augusta, who is called in from Port Augusta, the big town, to help the investigation into the missing six-year-old boy. And he's one of those people who writes books about the frontier, and he's very focused on what his next book will be. And will it be about the Native Australians? Yes, he thinks it will be. So it's his voice on the page that people will end up reading. Even though he's a fictional character, it's very kind of relevant to how history is recorded, as is Robinson's. So, Jock, on that, what is history and why is how it's recorded important?
Excellent. How long have we got? Well, I think the best way to answer that is the do not write this moment. Robinson was a bricklayer and he was a missionary. He was definitely not medically trained. And yet at Wibelina, every time somebody died, he would have the surgeon conduct a post-mortem and he would go to it and he would write his own set of notes. Those post-mortem notes of Robinson's are collected in the Plomley editions of Robinson's diaries, these enormous books, and they make extremely grim reading. But one that struck me and really affected me was that somewhere in the midst of all these post-mortem notes is the note of a post-mortem on a 12-year-old girl. And there is the usual stuff about respiratory disease. And then Robinson uses the sentence, clear evidence of sexual interference. And that's all he says. And I remember thinking that's impossibly harsh. And so he has, whatever has gone on there, he has chosen to leave it out of history, where he's extremely personally concerned with making history. Mm. So there's a choice in that. And I, as the writer of a fictionalization of that moment, I wanted to try to restore it so that Robinson turns, in my novel, Robinson turns to the surgeon. They are witness to this girl's body, and he says, you are to write none of this. And then as the author doing what Fiona and I are doing, I'm faced with this moment of, what if I put that back? And you're right, there's definitely an ethical dimension to this. I think there's also a process of bearing witness. And all of a sudden, the joyful, engaging, obsessive business of being a fiction writer becomes something awfully dark and serious. And you get a feeling of the gravity of what it is you're doing with history. Because in 200 years, the difference between me and anybody else who writes about Wibelina will be very, very hard to discern because of the way writing tends to, it has this sort of humus process where it all decomposes into the same pile. And people won't have as much of an opportunity to pick out the fact that I'm writing fiction from the fact that Robinson's writing a diary or Richard Flanagan wrote Mithinna, wrote Wanting, or whatever the case may be. So you have this responsibility that whatever you put into the humus pile to decompose with the rest of it has to be put there in good faith because it becomes so hard to disentangle.
Mm. And you decided to put that line in about do not write this, where they, it's not expressly said in the novel, but the historical source told you that it looked like it was sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Okay. And as a novelist, as a reader of the novel, one immediately assumes that it was not isolated. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and the potential perpetrator in Jock's novel is the catechist, the religious man. Okay. Isn't that tricky as well? Because you had one sentence by Robinson that suggested that sexual abuse, but in a novel, when you're reading it, you're going to, as a reader, think this is what's happening all the time on this island. This is endemic to this island, this sexual abuse of the Indigenous children.
Yeah. Clearly on the archive, we don't know. There are two other elements perhaps to this. One is that you can make certain deductions about that environment and the power structures within it. There are soldiers, there are convicts, there are white people in charge of very vulnerable black people. So there's inferences that can be drawn from the environment. They're not evidentiary ones. The other thing is that I'm also working with a character who has extended throughout the three books, who is supposed to be the embodiment of depravity. So when I wrote Preservation, I started with this idea that there were three survivors of the shipwreck. There was a merchant who was all about opportunism. He was looking at everything and thinking, how can I turn this to profit? There's a young boy who's looking at everything with the open eyes of a child and marveling at the beauty of everything around him. And he's honest and vulnerable. And then there's this man, Mr. Fig, who is there representing the depraved side of settlement. And I carried him through the three books because I wanted to keep coming back to that idea. And it means that in the settlement, he's there as the catechist, and there is this very, very difficult connection to make between that idea, that character, and that embodiment of evil, and what I do with it in the context of this very limited evidence of sexual assault. So I've tried, as far as I could, I've tried to pull right back from it, that there is that scene with the surgeon, but I haven't discussed the idea of that behaviour extending through the settlement much further than, and there's one discussion, I think, between the catechist and his wife about her hearing screaming.
Yes, that's true. You kind of keep it ambiguous, frankly.
Which I think it is.
Yeah. Okay. Fiona, the vicar in your novel, the six-year-old boy who's missing, is he lost in the bush or is a third party involved, becomes the question. There's a thriller-like aspect. There's a bloodied handkerchief found. There are tracks found. There are boys' boots found as they're searching for him. When it comes to people thinking about the possibility a third party is involved, the suspects are the Afghans with their camels, the Chinese, the indigenous people, and the vicar.
And swagman too.
And swagman. Yeah. I don't think the German, is she German? We don't even know. Prostitute with her donkey is a suspect, but she's another character. Well, just tell me about that. Why in the settler mind do they jump to those people as the likely suspects in the disappearance of a six-year-old boy?
Well, leaving out the vicar for now, because he is a special case and not the embodiment of evil in any
no,
way.
He's different to jocks. Yes.
I think it makes a perfect kind of sense that if someone is going to be at fault, then a small colonial town will perhaps in an act of wishful thinking that is itself deeply racist, be hoping that it's not one of us who has done this terrible thing. I mean, the difference, I suppose, in my story, in my novel, is that we know that nobody has taken Denny, you know, this, so this becomes part. Oh, we do, because we follow him the whole way through. It's not really spoiling anything. We're there with him every day. And we see what he's getting up to. So I suppose he could at some point have been whisked off, but we know that he hasn't. I mean, I suppose that kind of the irony there is part of the kind of a pleasure and critique of setting the situation up in that way, so that we can look at how sort of suspicions like that, but also sort of, I don't know, there's that voyeuristic thrill of something horrifying might have happened. It wasn't one of us, but it was one of these other entities that we think of as dangerous, or that we ignore until they feel as if they might be here to cause us harm. Whereas the vicar he's mostly quite ineffectual and just has the very bad luck in some ways of Sergeant Foster, who you mentioned earlier, the policeman who comes up from Port Augusta, but is also an amateur anthropologist and is writing about Australia. He fixes his sights on Mr. Daniels, the vicar, for various reasons, and is absolutely convinced that he has run off with the boy in some way. I don't think it's because he's a vicar, although I think he does have, Foster does have a deep impatience with the church and with the kind of do-gooders. I mean, do-gooders is a relative term, but that he sees as interfering in the glorious frontier or post-frontier that he thinks of himself as a hero of. So I suppose in some ways Daniel is off having his own hero's journey, trying to find Denny, and Foster needs this case solved, you know, just in the same sort of way that you encounter in true crime narratives that we read now. There's, you know, there's the policeman who just wants to find someone to blame, and for him it's Mr. Daniels. I think it is deliberate in the book that Daniels and Foster together go down a kind of narrative dead end, because I wanted the book to move away from the kind of either visionary religious narrative that we often encounter when we read about the Australian desert, or the very sort of policed kind of masculine heroic kind of language that also often, especially in the 19th century, sort of surrounds the way in which we think about the outback and lost children. So it's very deliberate that the two of those end up in a strange kind of dance together. Yeah, Mr. Daniels is just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
He is indeed. And you're right, Fiona, in that we do follow Denny through the novel. So I suppose the reader does have awareness of what he's doing, who's involved. But, and this spoiler alert we're not going to reveal, there is something that happens two-thirds of the way through where other people are involved, third parties are involved with Denny. And in fact, it goes, in a sense, to the writing of history, because his story could have been written slightly differently if the third parties had made different decisions. That's it. Spoiler alert. Right?
I love it.
Yeah. We'll just talk briefly, because we should, about God and religion, because I think the C words, you've each mentioned them. It's colonize, civilize, Christianize, if that's a word. That's the sort of the three things that Robinson wants to do. And I suspect in your novel, there are people with that in mind as well. In fact, in Fiona, in yours, I was struck when Denny's father, mother, I think, talks about how it's God's will what's going to happen, and that we only borrow our children from God. We don't; they're not ours. That approach, that God is in charge, as he is in your book. Talk about it, please.
Well, I suppose she, Mary, is the daughter of a missionary of an English sort of Reformed church missionary who brings a flock to South Australia, and she grows up with a very specific kind of worldview that is, you know, was deeply serious to her and to her father, who lost many, they lost her mother, they lost her siblings, all sorts of, you know, it's just Mary and her father left in the end. And there is a kind of enormous, terrible comfort, I suppose, in being able to look to this sovereign figure and feel that it's not just random, and it's not just sort of bad luck or absurdity or bad timing that means you lose people. And I think that Mary would like to be able to continue feeling that way, but whether or not she does is really the narrative arc that she goes through in the novel. That sense of, as you know, as a woman in particular, and as a woman who's been brought up in a certain tradition, she can't go out and look for Denny herself. She, all she can do is work and cook and pray and trust in God, until the point at which she decides that that's not enough anymore. I wanted that to be a complicated thing. I don't want it to come across sort of as a rejection of God necessarily, more just as a kind of you know, it's a moment of testing of belief, which, you know, is such a human thing to experience. And so when she does set off, and I know my mum is listening, so I'm going to mention that she sets off and does something strange with a tree that was entirely my mum's idea. So thanks, mum. that you know, she is at this point saying, okay, I still trust God, but I need to do something as well. So that feels it feels like that belief is being tested in the book, and particularly in her character.
Thanks. Jock, God is big in your book.
Yeah, there's a really interesting PhD thesis that I read about the teaching of scripture at Wybalina. And the author makes the point very much in Robinson's favour that people dislocated from their country and from their mythology somehow drew comfort from being taught scripture, and that they received it quite favourably. I disagree with that, but it's an interesting discussion. Robinson was all about, I think, the competing cosmologies, that he was trying to eradicate a cosmology. He constantly confiscated sacred items. He was very big on teaching hymns. And I was really interested in the end in this idea that there's a cosmology here and there's a Christian one that's been overlaid, and that one might be more verifiable than the other when they're both systems of belief. And that, when you think about it, has applied across the continent, that we're trying to stuff one cosmology onto the other one. And, I don't know that I buy the idea that it gave anybody any comfort.
Elizabeth, do we have to finish at...
Yeah.
Because we did start a bit late.
You make a good case.
and then we'll go to questions from the audience. Okay. Well, I haven't got much time then, so I better get to the really big questions. Do people in the audience have questions they want to ask?
Yeah.
Yes, so we won't dispense with them. Thank you. I saw you in Melbourne recently, didn't I? Kelly. Thank you, Kelly. All right, well, I shouldn't dally then. All right, let's go on to this then. In each of the novels, there is an idea that the Indigenous population are either out of sight, out of mind, or there until they become inconvenient, I suppose might be a way of putting it. In yours, definitely out of sight, out of mind. They're on an island, off an island, right? They've been corralled there and they're all dying, right? They give up easily, I think someone says at one point.
Mm.
Fiona, in yours, the Indigenous people, I'm thinking particularly of Billy Ruff, who's very good at cricket until he becomes so good they tell him not to play anymore. They remove him, sort of thing. And this is what I was saying earlier about historical fiction and timeliness. We've just had the voice referendum, right? I'll start with you, Jock. Are we in another case of out of sight, out of mind?
Oh, absolutely. One of the weird side effects of Robinson and his staff having taught the captors, the residents, the captives, call them what you will, to read and write was that they created Australia's first Aboriginal media, which was a little newsletter that they did called the Flinders Island Chronicle. And it was actually founded by a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old. And they, once they got going, they wrote a petition to Queen Victoria in 1846, asking her not to bring back this dreaded commandant who they hated, who was a guy called Degenerate, if you can believe that. They wrote this petition, and it still stands as the first petition by an Indigenous people to the reigning monarch in the history of the British Empire. These two kids managed to pull it off. And when you look at what the way the petition starts, and you can find the full text really easily online if you search the Wybalina petition, it starts with words to the effect of, "We, the free people of Tasmania, who have not surrendered our lands, were made certain promises which have not been honoured. We kept our part," is the kind of preface. So that's 1846. And you can then follow a trail through the various advocacy bodies, through William Cooper, through Vincent Langyari, through various sports people, all of whom have made the same point down through time, that we are here, we want to be recognised and we want to be heard. And I think one of the great fallacies of what we've just recently gone through is the idea that the request for a voice is a recent invention. Mm-hmm. That request has been consistent for such a long time, and that's one of the things that history shows you.
Thanks. Fiona, your thoughts?
It feels like an odd thing to be talking about from Berkeley, California. to be honest, it was a hard week watching something that I can no longer vote in when I know strongly how I would have voted. I really like the way Jock puts it, and I think just the other thing I would add is this kind of mischaracterization of what a voice is that sometimes appears. There's this sense that a voice is on the one hand, a completely sort of powerless, disembodied sort of thing, until someone you don't want speaking up is asking for it, and then suddenly, so many people who dismiss the arts or other sorts of activities that involve voice in complicated ways feel as if something truly precious is being asked for. So I suppose those were some of the things that struck me as I was following everything from here.
Thank you. Okay, now we'll go to questions from the audience. Kelly.
Sorry. I just wanted to extend that a little bit. Thank you all. You talked about the ethical decisions that you made when you were writing, and that's really fascinating, and that sort of unspoken idea of writing back to the archive or writing back to previous versions of history, recorded history. So I wondered whether what role do you think books like yours play in our national conversation, and were you thinking about that when you were writing, about what impact you might have or what role books like yours might have in our national conversations?
Do you want to go, Fiona? I don't know where to look.
I don't mind.
you
I mean, I'm happy to say very, very briefly.
Okay, you go first.
I'm happy to say very briefly that I was acutely conscious of it, that the entire project was in some way a writing back to Australian literature. There are lots of little Australian literature Easter eggs throughout the entire novel for, mm-hmm. for those who are interested to pick up on the ways in which literature in particular, but art in general, has been responsible for many of the representations that continue to sort of, you know, have been harmful or have fostered the complicity of people who thought they were doing the right thing but weren't. So absolutely everything. I mean, I think my book is really it's a love letter to Australian historical fiction and a love letter to Australian literature, and at the same time a kind of trial of it and of myself. You know, the reason that the novel is so full of artists behaving badly, having trouble trying to translate what it is they're experiencing and seeing onto a canvas or a piece of paper or into a book is that my book is really, really interested in this question: what is art for and who gets to make it and at what cost?
Thank you.
I agree with all of that, and I think I'd add that I'm definitely a relative newcomer to this work, and I don't have the answers, Kelly, to a lot of the things that you know about through your career. So I'm trying to feel my way into it instinctively. I worry sometimes that if you walk outside of this building into the sunshine and you did a vox pop in the street, people are not reading us and they don't know who we are. They may not even be aware of the issues that we're writing about. That's the cold reality of Australia, I think. But the flip side to that is, what do you do with that as a writer? It's an act of defiance. You can probably tell that this material makes me angry. It still makes me angry. And what do you do with that anger? You write as an act of defiance, and you write because if you don't write it, no one's going to write it. So I don't have the idea that anything that I write is going to bend the arc of Australia remotely. But I also feel this compulsion to write it down because it's something constructive to do with the anger, I think.
Thank you. Okay, another question. Yes.
Thank you. Great combo. Fiona, you just talked then about a love letter to Australian literature. And for the research for my last book, I came to Mina Kelthorpe's The Die House with your beautiful introduction to it. And I was terrified that I'd missed that previously and terrified about all the other Australian books I might be missing. Are there some others that you would recommend that we go back to read? Because I found Kelthorpe extraordinary.
She's wonderful, isn't she? You know, and the reason you got to read her is because the Text Classic series exists, and we have this extraordinary opportunity to read this stuff that we wouldn't necessarily. I mean, I had no idea who Mina Kelthorpe was. I bought her from Gould's Books in Newtown back when it still existed, and I was living in Newtown, and I was reading about Newtown and McDonaldtown, and in this wonderful book about the dying of fabric, you know, the industry around the dying of fabric, and sent it to Michael and said, I think you might want to publish this one. This one is great. And there is that sort of, there's the thrill and joy, I suppose, that it's still possible to come across a book like this. And also the thrill and joy of having someone like Michael Hayward at Text who is willing to publish these things and remind us that we have Elizabeth Harrower, we have all of these wonderful, wonderful writers. So, I think Michael's done that work. There's no one I can think of that I would sort of insist that must be published that hasn't been. That's my own ignorance as well. But I do know that I got given all of the Text Classics because I wrote the introduction to the 100th, and they're all in my office at Berkeley. And when my students come in, they say, "What are these yellow books?" And I say, "That is Australian literature, and you should read it."
That's a good answer. So there's your answer. Get them all. Mike will be happy. Another question over this way.
Sorry, last question.
Last question, okay.
Thank you both. How do you balance, weigh up, cope with writing Indigenous characters into your story?
Fiona, do you want to start?
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to, but I spoke last.
Okay. Well, my approach, I think I was learning on the job, and I have a few ideas about that. One is that as a settler Australian, I don't think you should shirk it. I think you should engage with it, and that to say you might get in trouble is a bit cowardly. The obvious counterpoint to that is that you have to do the work. You have to research before you write anything. You have to talk to people and make sure that you're then talking to the right people. You have to listen to what you're told. Oftentimes we consult with people and say, "Thanks very much, but that doesn't really fit what I'm doing." And I think consulting with Indigenous people is not like that, because what you're being told is Indigenous storytelling, which is cultural currency. It's a lot different to us simply sharing a yarn with each other. So you take what you're told seriously. And there are lots of good protocols around, the Australia Council, obviously, and a lot of municipal councils now have referral mechanisms if you're looking for a traditional owner and they take you to the right place. The other thing that I think is important to say about it is that far from getting told off or being intimidated, what I overwhelmingly found was friendship and support. And enthusiasm. Indigenous people who wanted you to write that thing, but also to write these other things. So I think we can get too caught up in the negativity. It can be a wonderfully cooperative process. But the bottom line is to do the detailed work.
Thank you. Fiona?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, for me, it was a matter of stepping in with humility, understanding that there was so much that I didn't know, and being ready to listen, to spend time on country, to talk with people, to use sensitivity readers all the way through the whole experience, etc.
Thank you. And here we'll finish with a historical fact. Two authors who I don't think have met before.
No,
correct.
No.
Whose novels are set 50 years apart, roughly. Each of them have a reference to the Pied Piper of Hamelin in them. How does that happen? Really? But it does. Please join me in thanking Jock and Fiona for being here.
Thank you, Fiona.
Thanks.
Thanks,
thanks Stephen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. polled from the 2023 HNSA conference held in Sydney. Just a reminder that 2025 is conference year and details will soon be announced. Visit our website hnsa.org.au, join our Facebook group and subscribe to our newsletter to be up to date. And please explore our podcast archive, treasure trove of historical ideas. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.